Happy holidays from Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Today, we speak with writer Christos Gage. Gage has made his mark on television shows like Numbers and Law & Order SVU. A couple years ago, he wrote a Deadshot miniseries for DC that redefined the character. He's in the midst of an exciting Union Jack miniseries with Mike Perkins for Marvel and just began a new Stormwatch series at Wildstorm with Doug Mankey. This week, Marvel releases a one-shot Civil War tie-in as the series' two heroes face off in Iron Man, Captain America, Casualties of War, with art from Jeremy Hahn. Our conversation begins with a look at Chris's childhood and the difficulties in getting American comic books while overseas. You grew up as a kid in Greece getting American comics, and I wonder how available American comics are over in Greece.
Well, let me see. I was actually born in New York.
Okay.
My dad had grown up in, he was born in Greece, but had grown up in Worcester, Massachusetts. So I was born in New York, but when I was, I guess, about six, we moved to Greece for 5 years. My father worked for the New York Times, and he was made their Athens correspondent. So I had already been reading both Marvel and DC comics, you know, as a little kid. And then when I was living in Greece, I found that there was a grocery store around the corner from my house that got comics, but only Marvel comics. So basically, you know, you would get all the you know, Fantastic Four, Spider-Man, the various Marvel comics, and they would come like once a month in one, you know, everything Marvel put out that month, but not everything. Like, I remember seeing ads for like Devil Dinosaur and wanting it and never seeing it, you know. And then, of course, there would be the times where, like, Spider-Man just wouldn't show up that month. So,
okay.
You know, then you'd get the next issue. So, you know, until we moved back to the States, you know, when I was 11 or so, you know, and I actually found comic book stores, you know, I didn't know how the story came out, which, of course, when you're a little kid, it seems like an eternity, you know.
Sure.
And you build up in your head what possibly could have happened in Peter Parker number 55, you know, and then you get it and you're like, well, that was kind of anticlimactic.
Your idea was probably better than the one they came up with.
Exactly, you know. Not that what they came up with was bad, but like you build it up in your head, you know.
Sure.
And then at the Athens Hilton, we went to the Athens Hilton one day, stopped there before a road trip, and I picked up my first X-Men comic, which was 139, which was when Kitty Pryde joins the team and Nightcrawler and Wolverine go out to Canada, and they have to fight the Wendigo. And, you know, then I just loved it, and we got back from the trip, and I looked for the next issue, but the next issue I got was 141, which was Days of Future Past, which, of course, you know, was awesome and is really what hooked me for life. But, you know, for the longest time, I needed to know what happened in 140, and, like, I had my grandmother in Pasadena get it for me for, like, a Christmas present and mail it to me in Greece. It was funny.
Came as a care package.
Yeah, exactly.
That's really cool.
But for whatever reason, they didn't have DC comics, so I was kind of a Marvel guy until about the time of Crisis on Infinite Earth when I started picking up DCs again.
That's cool. Now, were you a typical, you know, comic book reader, would you say, in terms of reading it, and then suddenly we discover girls and we go away for a while?
No. I never... I did discover the girls, but I didn't exactly, you know, wear my Superman logo T-shirt or anything like that around the ladies, but I was not about to, you know, I was not about to give up a sure thing, you know, I mean, comics were a sure thing. Girls, you know, the jury was still out, you know.
Girls would come and go, but comics were always there every Wednesday.
Exactly. Actually, back then it was Friday.
You started to mention before we started rolling tape about some of the other creators that are Greek, and the audience will forgive us, but you know, Greeks always are excited to find out that other Greeks are involved in a specific industry.
Absolutely.
So you mentioned that actually your collaborator on Stormwatch, Doug Mankey, is part Greek.
He is. He's part Greek, and and that's actually how we met. Was on the when I was writing Deadshot, he came on the DC boards and asked me if I was Greek, and my dad's a prominent Greek writer. And he asked me if he was my dad, and I said yes. And, you know, we just got to talking online. We still never met face-to-face and, you know, hit it off. And we already knew that we would like to work together at some point because I was a huge fan of his. I loved what he did on, you know, books like JLA and Batman. And, you know, that's how we, you know, I mean, obviously he had also worked with Wildstorm before. Ben Abernathy, the editor, is a huge fan of his. He had done Team Zero with Doug, and you know, but that's one of the reasons we ended up working together.
That's cool. Yeah, I've been a big fan as well, and I just enjoyed that Team Zero miniseries he did with Chuck Dixon.
Yeah.
That was fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the great thing about Doug is he's very versatile. Like, he can do a war story. He can do, you know, he did The Mask back in the
yes.
day. He can do humor. He can do horror. You know, he can do so many different things and do them equally well, which is very, very rare skill.
Well, before we start talking about Stormwatch, let's mention, are there any other Greek creators that we're aware of out there?
Chris Eliopoulos.
Of course, yes. Of course, the great letterer and man who created Franklin Richards, Son of a Genius.
That's right. There was, let's see, well, of course, George Roussos was the old school, the dean of the Greeks in the industry.
That's right.
The longtime inker on the early Batmans back in the day, I think back in the Golden Age or mm-hmm. the 50s at least. And so he would be the dean, the you know, the father, the grandfather of us all. As far as current creators in the industry, there is, I'm sure I'm going to forget somebody. Well, Peter Tomasi at DC, the editor.
I didn't know that. Okay.
Greek. And I feel like I'm forgetting somebody. But there are other Greeks in the industry.
That's very cool. Well, let's talk about Stormwatch for a second, because I like the concept. I didn't read many of the previous incarnations of Stormwatch.
Mm-hmm.
And
could you follow the story?
Absolutely.
Okay, good.
Yeah, I honestly could. And I like the idea of humans versus super people.
Mm-hmm.
And from, that standpoint. And I know the previous stories kind of followed in that same vein as well. But this clearly is more of a police procedural. It reminds me a lot, in a good way, of what David Hyde was trying to do with Mutant X as well,
uh-huh.
in terms of you know, showing how you know, cops would kind of deal with, you know, super criminals and super events and how they would be able to handle it. And I like the fact that you're really underlining the fact that this particular squad is under some serious budget restraints as well.
Right. Well, yeah, that came from I've written for television cop shows like Law and Order SVU and Numbers, and I remember I was actually in New York. My wife and I co-wrote those, and I was talking to some actual cops who were, you know, I can't remember if they were actually, you know, providing security on the show or if they were just walking the beat and stopped by to check things out. But there was a funny story where they came on to the set and the costume, the wardrobe manager, I'm not sure if that's the correct title, but the person in charge of the costumes came over to them and started, like, adjusting their collars and stuff, thinking they were extras. And they were like, no, we're actual cops. And it was really funny. But I started talking to them and said, you know, the shows, are they realistic? I mean, obviously, real cops don't solve a crime in an hour, you know. But, you know, relatively speaking, are they realistic? And they were very complimentary. But the one thing that I've heard, not just from them, but from other people in law enforcement as well, is that, you know, whereas on a show like CSI or the Law and Order shows, sometimes you'll see this amazing forensic equipment that they use to solve the crime, and that equipment may well exist, but very few police departments can actually afford them in their budget, because
sure.
they have very tight budgets. I mean, you hear about it all the time, and I actually think that Warren Ellis, in one of his issues of Fell, you know, commented on this, where the main character says, you know, what about DNA testing? And his boss says, do we look like we can afford a DNA lab? You know, so I wanted to highlight that in the, you know, sort of bring that real world aspect of things into the story, because, you know, obviously, as comic book fans, we're used to reading about, you know, Bruce Wayne, who's a millionaire and can finance his bat plane and all this cool stuff. And, you know, the organizations like the original Stormwatch seem to have endless supplies of funding. And that's cool in its own right, because you don't have to worry about where does this stuff come from. But I thought it might be interesting to take the other approach and, you know, have people who have to deal with not having things and how do they react to it. So
I also think it affords the opportunity to see a lot of interesting characterization, because so many times the average person is really there to either be saved or, you know, or is the criminal. I mean, you know, it's nice to see that the focus is the human, and that the, you know, the bad guy or the problem is, you know, the super being.
Yeah, well, you know, and there are a lot of, I mean, I tried to make some of the characters archetypes that we've seen in comics, but ones that are usually in supporting roles, you know, like whether it be sidekicks or, you know, tech wizards or girlfriends or, you know, that type of thing, assistants, the cops, you know, you know, what you would call, you know, in a play, spear carriers, you know.
Yes, absolutely.
And sort of bring them to the forefront and examine things from their point of view. So, yeah, I'm glad that you like that, because that's exactly, especially in the Wildstorm universe, you haven't seen a lot of that street-level type of perspective, because, you know, I mean, the great books that we remember, like The Authority and the Warren Ellis Stormwatch and Wildcats, tend to take a big sort of macro view of everything, and, you know, that's great. And actually, one of the reasons that I decided to take the opposite approach is because you've got Grant Morrison writing Wildcats and The Authority, so... What am I going to compete with Grant Morris with, you know? No, I think I'll try to do something a little bit different, you know, a different perspective. So that's kind of, you know, that entered into my thinking as well.
WorldStorm is the big event that's going on in all the WildStorm titles, and Stormwatch is a part of it. There's already been announcements that some of those books are late. How much of that lateness impacts the story that you're telling?
Well, it doesn't really, because at first, and I think the thinking was that we weren't going to cross over in the early days, in large part so that each book could find its own. We didn't want people to go into it thinking, I either have to buy all the Wildstorm titles or none of them. You know, we wanted people, I mean, hopefully people will buy them all, but we wanted people to say, okay, you know, I'm going to try Wildcats, and, you know, maybe I'll try Deathblow and Stormwatch, you know, sort of pick and choose or give all of them a try, and if they, you know, some aren't to their taste, they can stay with others. So we wanted each book to sort of stand on its own. So there weren't really any crossovers planned in the early days. I think there's one in Wildcats and Authority, which Grant is writing both of those. But I don't know exactly how that will be affected. But in terms of, like, Gale's doing Gen 13, I'm doing Stormwatch, Brian Azzarello's doing Deathblow, and they're all standing on their own. So it's not going to be a problem in that regard. I mean, I've tried to, you know, do things in Stormwatch that show, yes, this is a shared universe, like mentioning the Spartan robots, which are these,
yes,
you know, robots that the Halo Corporation and Wildcats sells to people, you know, to almost be personal servants. And so I've mentioned those, but there are no direct crossovers that, you know, that should be affected. So, and Stormwatch, by the way, is on time.
Very good. Congratulations.
Thank you.
How long is this first story going to run?
Well, it's the first larger arc is going to run 7 issues, but really it's almost like a TV show in the, I guess, you know, if you take Lost as an example, you know, the first episode started with the plane crash and sort of the big disaster that brought everyone into the story, and then each subsequent episode did move the larger story forward but focused on a particular character. So, and it's kind of the same with the first 7 issues of Stormwatch. Each issue is going to focus on one or two characters as they come into the spotlight, and we find out, you know, what they're all about, something about their backstory, who they are. And so there will kind of be a self-contained story within each of those issues. And then the last 2 issues, issues 6 and 7, are a two-parter. And then starting with issue 8, it'll be a little bit more conventional, more of a conventional team book, because by that time, we'll know all the characters, and, you know, you can sort of give each one of them a little bit of face time with the readers already knowing something about them.
How many of the supervillains that we see in that first issue are original ones? And I'll give a specific example. Is Pagliacci a new creation of yours, or is that something?
Yeah, that's a new character.
That was great. That was true. I mean, I think we could all tell who he was emulating, much in the same way that... Oh, and I'm blanking on his name now. Apollo's lover in The Authority.
Oh, right. Midnighter.
Midnighter. How much Midnighter is like Batman? I think Pagliacci certainly has a lot of Joker in him. But it was. I mean, that's great, and I think that's really cool. And in fact, even one of the team members, I think people who haven't picked up the book yet will see a very strong resemblance to a pretty famous Marvel hero.
Right.
So,
well, and it's funny because there are similarities to that character, Dr. Shaw, and the Hulk, but really when I was thinking about it, I was thinking more along the lines of the Lizard, the Spider-Man villain.
Oh, sure.
You know, somebody like that. But there definitely are there are similarities to the Hulk, but obviously we're trying to do things, differentiate things. In fact, you mentioned Doug. One of the great things he added is when this guy's a scientist who turns into a monster, and the monster is part, he's sort of a Daemonite crossbreed. Daemonites are the aliens in the Wildstorm universe, and they have 4 arms. And Doug misinterpreted something I'd written, so when the guy changed back to human form, he gave him an extra set of arms, smaller, you know, a second set of smaller arms, and I just thought that was so cool because it separates him from Bruce Banner and the Hulk, for one thing, but also, you know, he's not a normal guy, and he can never really forget it just by changing back into his human form. So it was one of those lucky accidents. You're asking about the villains. Two of them have been seen before. There was Defile, who's sort of the main bad guy.
Okay.
And he was seen previously in the original Stormwatch run, but he was more of like a behind-the-scenes schemer, and we tried to make him a little bit more of a, you know, active, you know, ass-kicking kind of guy.
Okay.
And then Deathtrap, who is a super-powered mercenary, has been seen before. The others, I believe, are all new.
I would say for people who haven't picked up this new Stormwatch, it, in its own way, it's like the police procedural version of, in a lot of ways, what Garth Ennis is also doing with The Boys.
Yeah, and it's funny because I met Derek Robertson, at the artist of The Boys, at San Diego this past year, and we were talking about it, and he said, yeah, and I said, yeah, you know, when I heard about your book, I was like, oh, boy, I hope we're not covering the same ground, and he said the same, and turned out that we're, you know, we're taking pretty different approaches.
Yeah.
I love that book, The Boys, you know, typical, you know, Garth Ennis sort of over-the-top, hard-hitting type of stuff, and like you said, mine is more, you know, police procedural, you know, street level type of, I guess, cop story.
Yeah, picking up even where Brubaker and Rucka were, well, the same thing they were doing in the DCU with something like Gotham Central, but
absolutely,
a little bit more tech to it.
In fact, I described it at San Diego at the Wildstorm panel as Gotham Central meets Suicide Squad.
There you go.
Which are two of my favorite DC books.
That's cool. And yeah, you know, as we move into the DCU, let's talk about the Suicide Squad, specifically Deadshot.
Yeah.
A character you really dusted off and really made your own with that miniseries.
Yeah, I had a good time with that.
And it's cool that I think Gail Simone kind of picked up on a lot of what you were doing and, you know, ran with it in Villains United and now in Secret Six.
Definitely, yeah. Gail's terrific.
And are you guys, you know, in conversation in terms of where she is leaving the character? Because you're going to pick up Deadshot again in Legends of the Dark Knight, am I correct?
Well, yeah. The Legends of the Dark Knight story is a one-off. It's a done-in-one story. It's actually the last issue of Legends of the Dark Knight.
Yeah.
And that one, it doesn't really affect what Gail's doing. It's sort of like a, you know, matching wits, Batman versus Deadshot type of thing. So it doesn't really affect the larger continuity, although it refers to it. So that wasn't really an issue. I mean, I told her, you know, sent her an email saying what I was going to do. I think I sent her the script. And she was actually great. When I was writing the initial Deadshot miniseries, she contacted me and said, I'm going to be doing this Villains United. You know, we've been in touch. We haven't really, you know, it hasn't really been an issue. I don't know. I like to read her stuff, you know, as a reader, as a fan, find out, you know, where she's going with it when it comes out. But, yeah, she's actually been terrific as far as, you know, I kind of had a feeling that someone whoever ended up writing Deadshot after me might, like, kill off his kid, you know, because it would be an easy way to do, like, a, you know, Deadshot on the path to vengeance type of story. But Gail actually didn't go the easy route. She sort of used it to, you know, deepen his character and take it in different directions, which I think is terrific.
That's cool. Would you, do you see yourself, you know, pitching an idea maybe to do a Deadshot Catman kind of story? Because it seems like there's his Sundance to his Butch Cassidy in
terms definitely.
Of...
I'd love to do something like that, and probably will at some point. At the moment, I'm literally, my plate is full, I'm not, you know, that's not something that I'm working on right now. But, you know, whenever, I mean, I love the character of Deadshot, and any opportunity to write him is something I like to do. So, yeah, I'm sure I will at some point.
That's cool. Was Ostrander pretty much the writer that you kept in mind when you first took on the character?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, that's what I had read. I've read the entire run of Suicide Squad. I think it was 66 issues, you know, from beginning to end when it was coming out. And then I read it again before writing that. And I just think he really gave, you know, fleshed out the character of Deadshot and gave him, you know, some substance, some meat, you know, took him beyond. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to, you know, downplay what Steve Englehart and Marshall Rogers did and whoever initially created the character back in the 50s. But, you know, I think that John Ostrander really, you know, really looked into the character's backstory and gave him some depth and fleshed him out. And, you know, so I really wanted to be faithful to that. And actually on his message board, he said that he liked the book, which I was very pleased with.
That's cool. John's a really cool guy.
Yeah, I've never met him. I'd like to.
He's great, and he's doing great work with the Star Wars characters. And Suicide Squad was such a terrific book, and I think
it's tremendously influential when you talk to people who are working in the industry.
You bet. It's self-evident in all the books that are coming out now.
Yeah.
I mean, I know Rucka's a huge fan, obviously, and Gail is clearly a fan. So would you, if you were to get the shot at doing the Suicide Squad, who would be on your team?
Deadshot, obviously. you know, then, I mean, a variety of... Deadshot's my only, like, you know, must...
Sure.
You know, character. beyond that, you know, it would be fun to sort of mix and match. You know, like, I like mixing up villains who are just hardcore bad guys, you know, with villains who are more, you know, shades of gray type guys who might have their own moral code and might not be completely bad, because it makes a fun mix with them and the real, like, psychopaths. You know, it's like the Dirty Dozen. I mean, obviously, Suicide Squad was based on the Dirty Dozen.
Absolutely.
And, you know, you've got Telly Savalas in that movie playing the psychotic serial killer. And then you've got the guys who were in jail for punching a superior officer, you know,
Jim Brown and those
weren't
guys.
Bad guys. Yeah, Jim Brown.
So. Or Cassavetes. We need a Cassavetes.
We do, who also was Greek.
That's right.
It just always goes back to that.
You know, well, I was going to eventually dovetail back in that anyway and say, with all the Greek Greek mythology that's entwined in so many superheroes, how come there isn't just one flat-out Greek superhero out there? Where the hell is
Hercules?
It? Yeah, all right. Well, there you go. But again, a Greek god and stuff. I mean, you know, yeah I guess you could point to Venus and, you know.
Well, one of the characters in Stormwatch is Greek now.
Yes, I know. And I meant to mention that as well. Exactly. What's his name again?
His character name is the Machinist, and his real name is Dino Manolis. And
yeah.
His whole thing is he's a 40-ish washed-up tech villain who's sort of, you know, never amounted to anything, and this is kind of his last shot at, you know, staying out of jail. You know, he's like, if he goes back to jail one more time, he's there for forever, you know. So this is kind of his last shot, and he's sort of like a, you know, he's out of shape and, you know, losing his hair, and, you know, he's, you know, kind of a hard luck guy. But he's made a lot of his own hard luck, you know. He's so...
Hair loss aside, I think I'm relating to Dino Manolis in a lot of ways, unfortunately. Being a
yeah, exactly.
Comic fan. And, you know, I wanted to say, too, I think as they nudge the Marvel family more and more into the Egyptian and Middle Eastern mythology, I got to say flat out, I always thought Billy Batson was Greek.
He's got that curly hair.
Exactly, and very swarthy looking. And Captain Marvel has the beetle brow, kind of almost a unibrow and stuff.
Exactly, you know. But it's hard to tell with that outfit. But you can't tell if he's got the back hair that really makes you great.
Which we know Dino definitely has.
Oh yes. Oh yeah.
Before we get to Marvel, I want to make sure that I'm catching all the right DC things. So, am I missing anything as far as?
Nothing that's been announced.
Okay, very cool. And you know, you're doing great work with the DCU. And it's cool that you're able to work with both companies and as comfortably as you are, because I think you're really doing great work with both. As I told you in my first email to you, I love the Union Jack series.
Oh yeah, that's a lot of fun. No, I love working for both companies, and the people are great at both, and, you know, no complaints on my end. I mean, it's great to be able to, you know, to work on Stormwatch one week and then Union Jack the next week and then Batman and then, you know, Spider-Man. I did a Spider-Man story.
Yes.
I mean, it's like having, you know, it's like when you're a kid and you have all the action figures and you get to make up your own stories. You know, it's awesome.
It's cool because you've laid down this foundation, and I guess this happens with a lot of writers where you have to almost prove yourself with characters that might be perceived as C-level characters before getting a chance at one of the big boys. Now, as you said, you did do your Spider-Man Unlimited story, which is a forum for newer creators.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I love this Union Jack miniseries, and it's an entire group of what might be called C-list characters.
Yeah.
And I'm thrilled that you got Mike Perkins to work with you, because I've been a fan of his. I really wasn't aware of him until CrossGen and Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, he's terrific. He was at CrossGen, and he was the inker on Ruse, and he was the penciler on Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. And he's amazing. I mean, he's a terrific guy. I've never met him in person, but talked to him on the phone. And he's got a beautiful art style. And, I mean, he's doing the great work on Captain America every other arc. I believe it was Mike who did the Civil War stories that are running now, and that's just beautiful stuff. The thing about Mike is he's just a consummate professional, you know, and he's really good at what he does, and a good guy. So, you know, we're actually going to be working together again, but I can't say on what.
Okay. And, yeah, I know that the Union Jack miniseries is only four issues, but I've really enjoyed it so far. It's a nice international group of heroes that...
Thanks. Yeah, that was one of the ideas, is to sort of play up the international side of the Marvel Universe and show that, you know, it's a big world, and they have characters everywhere.
Well, and it's a great MI5 kind of story as well. I've been a fan of Union Jack going back to the Invader days,
mm-hmm.
and it's nice to see, you know, Ben Rabb really kind of started the ball rolling with Joey Chapman, and it was a good first story, him and John Cassaday. And you got the nice push from Brubaker as well in that London story.
Yeah, it was actually his idea. Ed was the one who suggested doing a Union Jack. I mean, Andy Schmidt and I were talking about what to do together, and... there was some talk since I'd done Deadshot of doing a Crossbones miniseries, which is one of the villains from mm-hmm. Captain America. And Andy checked with Ed, and he said, well, I'm going to be using him a lot in the main book. But he said, you know, how about Union Jack? I'm going to be doing a story where Cap goes to Britain, and I'd like to bring Union Jack into that, and maybe we could spin something out of that, because he loves Union Jack, too. And, you know, it just kind of all fell into place from there. But, yeah, it was terrific that we got to sort of spin right out of that storyline.
And, again... focusing on Joey Chapman as a working class hero, and this way we're kind of seeing the British class system in action in this story.
Well, the thing about that, you know, was really interesting, because when Andy and I first started talking, Andy said, you know, I'd really like for this to be a story that could only be about Union Jack, you know, not something that you could plug in Captain Britain or, you know, Captain America or Daredevil or whoever
sure.
into the protagonist role, and essentially the story would be unchanged. So I went back and took a look at the earliest appearances, which I'd read before, of Joey Chapman, which was in Captain America 253 and 254, and you know, realized that what really sets him apart from a lot of characters, and especially from even the previous men who wore the costume of Union Jack, is that he's a working class guy. And interestingly, at the time that, you know, I was working on the pitch, was around the time of Hurricane Katrina, which is where we saw that, you know, not in Britain, but in our country, you know, definitely it's the case as well, that when a disaster hits, the people who, you know, who get it worst are the people who are at the lowest end of the socioeconomic ladder. And it kind of all sort of tied together, and I thought, you know, you know, why not do a story that plays on that and really, you know, brings out the background of the character and, you know, sort of hits him where he lives, as it were. So.
There's a lot of action in that story as well, which is
yeah.
neat. And is the Arabian Knight a new character?
That is a new... Well, there was an Arabian Knight before. He was introduced in Contest of Champions way back in the day. But he was killed off in an issue of Thunderbolts. And we decided to create a new one. And, you know, there had been... I mean, the previous one was sort of, you know, a guy in a turban on a flying carpet, you know. And there were some people who felt that it was a bit of a stereotype, you
sure.
know, an Arabic stereotype, you know, the Sinbad the Sailor type thing. So we wanted to try to create a guy that was a little more modern, you know, a modern soldier, but with a few medieval touches. You know, he's got the magic sword, and
right.
he's got the sash, and he's got these great bracelets that Mike designed. So it's kind of an interesting mix of the past and the present.
And it's great to see him having to deal with a teammate like the Israeli Sabra.
Yeah, that was an obvious sort of way of, not obvious, but like they would have a natural conflict.
Sure.
And, you know, it's kind of fun to bring together characters who have, you know, built-in tensions between them and see what happens.
No, it's really cool. And great to see Val Valentina from S.H.I.E.L.D. Pop up, because it's with Nick Fury gone, it's nice to see that, you know, everyone is kind of grabbing all these other great, you know, S.H.I.E.L.D. characters and bringing them up. You see Dum Dum Duggan, and now I'm blanking. I forget which book he's suddenly in Wolverine.
Mm-hmm.
In Wolverine
yeah, well,
Origins and stuff.
Well,
so
Mike is a huge, huge fan. I believe he was the one who suggested it. He's a huge fan of, you know, I mean, as am I, but Mike is definitely a huge fan of the old Steranko Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. books. So, you know, he was just so happy to be able to draw Val that, you know, he really got a kick out of it.
That's cool. And we even see the old flying cars just like from the Steranko era, too. So.
Oh, yeah, you got to love the flying cars, you know, which, of course, every time you see one, it's going to get destroyed in some way. But, you know.
Well, that's what's cool. I mean, this is a cool – I think both companies are churning out very interesting stories that might be flying under the radar because of the big events that each are involved mm-hmm. with right now.
Yeah.
And I think Union Jack is a good example. And then conversely, you've got the one-shot coming up in December with Iron Man and Cap, Casualties of War.
Right.
Jeremy Hahn doing a great job on the art for that.
Absolutely.
I'm a big fan of Jeremy's.
And, yeah, he's really good.
Tell me about the story now, because there's a moment that clearly, you know, we've still got two more issues of Civil War to get through before the end, so this is kind of an interlude where the two main, you know, protagonists are going to face off.
Yeah, well, it was actually a case where it was not originally on the schedule, and when it became clear that the main Civil War book was going to have to be delayed a bit, you know, Marvel took a look at, you know, well, we'd like to put out some specials that will, you know, sort of, I mean, you know, fill the void, you know, fill mm-hmm. people's, you know, hunger for Civil War material, but also sort of fill in some of the questions people had about it. And, you know, one of the big ones people were asking is, you know, these Captain America and Iron Man have been allies and friends for so long, you know, how come they haven't tried to get together and talk this out in a more peaceful way? And, you know, in the main Civil War book, things have been kind of fast and furious, so if that did happen, we didn't get to see it. So we thought about, hey, you know, that's a really good point. Let's tell that story and look back on their shared history and take a look at why, you know, things could get to this point. And, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I don't want to give too much away about the story, but when you look back at their history together, first of all, it makes sense to me as to why each guy would take the stance that he has. And, you know, it also makes sense that things could get pretty tense between them. So, you know, I don't want to say too much because I don't want to give anything away, but it's definitely an examination of, I mean, basically the story is they have a secret meeting in the ruins of Avengers Mansion to try to see if they can work it out and without any further, you know, violence and hostilities man to man. And there's some flashbacks, there's some present day stuff, and we really look at their relationship and, you know, see what happens. So.
That's cool. Well, and I think as you said, I think Marvel has turned what would have been a negative into a plus in terms of the delays of that were happening with Civil War. It does give them the opportunity to come up with these one-shots and tell a much bigger story and get into some very deep characterization and verbalize the differences in, you know, each position on this issue.
Well, that can happen when you're doing a big sweeping event like Civil War. You know, things go so fast and furious that, as you point out, the character moments can sometimes, you know, get we go by so fast that you don't get to see those character moments. And, you know, the Choosing Sides one shot got to show how some of these different characters, you know, got involved, like why Iron Fist was wearing the Daredevil costume and that type of thing. And, you know, like you said, it's sort of getting approaching things from a more character oriented viewpoint and showing some of the things that you couldn't show in the main miniseries.
Is it hard to write for both sides
of
the argument?
Well, I mean, not really, because, you know, it's funny because people ask me what side am I on, and, you know, as a fan, I mean, I'm sort of on Captain America's side. It's like, well, these guys are heroes. They shouldn't have to register, you know, but then if I was actually living in a world where people could throw trucks around and shoot lasers from their eyes, I mean, you're damn right I would want them to be registered with the government. You know, I don't want somebody, you know, running around half-cocked, you know, blowing up my neighborhood. You know, I want to feel like they're being supervised somehow. So it's more putting yourself in the perspective of, you know, the person, which you kind of have to do anytime you write a character. But, you know, in this case, I could totally see both sides, so it wasn't difficult at all.
Does this kind of whet your appetite to do more Iron Man and Captain America stories?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love those characters. I was just so excited when, you know, Andy called me up and said that, you know, they were considering me for the project. Because, you know, I mean, not only is it a huge part of a huge event, I mean, you know, to get to write those characters is exciting enough, but to get to write such an important key moment in their history is really, really exciting to me.
That's really great.
Yeah.
Well, I did want to ask about your television and film work. And
sure.
You know, it's interesting, as you say, and how you want to map out Stormwatch, it sounds like you've got the right idea behind telling a big story, but also making sure that there's a small story each month that people can check out. I really think that, and I'm curious, as someone who works in the business, that right now television seems to have the advantage in storytelling, because it's funny, for the longest time it seemed like movies had the advantage because of a budget standpoint, mm-hmm. and it seemed like that they were able to tackle, you know, tougher issues. But now with the sophistication of, I think, dramas that are appearing on cable and also network television's reaction to those dramas, I think we're seeing a lot more better storytelling in TV shows than we're seeing lately in the movies.
Yeah, I think that's very true, and I think you're also seeing actors who at one time, you know, would not have done television are now, you know, embracing it for that very reason. You know, it's interesting because when I first got into the business, I was in film school. That's where my wife and I met, and, you know, became writing partners as well. And even then, there was more of a division. You know, you worked in television or you worked in film. And, you know, there was not a lot of back and forth thing. You know, if you work, and film was considered superior. If you went from film to TV, you were sort of taking a step down. And very soon, in fact, even when we were still in film school, that started to go away, where you had people going back and forth, people like Joss Whedon and David Mamet, my wife just pointed out.
And, you bet.
You know, and doing great work in both mediums, and people started realizing, hey, why consider them separate like that? You know, I mean, as you said very, very perceptively, you can actually tell much more in-depth stories in terms of the character development and that sort of thing in television than you can in a two-hour movie because, you know, you've got 22 hours in a season, in
yep.
a full season. So, yeah, there's a lot of stuff you can do. And like you said, the HBOs of the world have sort of raised the bar in terms of now there are one of the other problems was content. You couldn't do really, you know, there were certain areas you couldn't go into in you know, The Sopranos was originally developed for Fox, and I believe they felt it was just too violent. And I can't imagine that as a network show. I can't imagine it without, I mean, one of the important things about it to me is showing the violence and showing that, you know, this is not a glorified mob. These are people who do horrible, violent things.
You bet.
So, I mean, yeah, it really, and that also kind of gets into the idea of comics, which is now you're seeing a lot of people from Hollywood and novelists and other places doing comics as well, and there isn't that stigma attached to it like there used to be where, you know, if you were Jerry Conway and you went from writing comics to writing for television, there was no looking back, you know, because it would be a step down career-wise.
Sure. Know? Well, and I also wonder if that was more, and I didn't mean to step on you there.
No.
But I also wonder if that's more an American thing, because it seems like the British, for many more years, never really had that kind of stigma attached, and it was, from an acting standpoint, acting is acting. From a writing standpoint, writing is writing. And Neil Gaiman would get his opportunities to write TV or film, mm-hmm. books, and, you know, comics was just another thing to write.
Exactly, yeah. And I think that, you know, and you know, I mean, in Britain, of course, you've got the stage tradition, and,
yep.
you know, there was the stage as well. And
radio, for that matter.
Radio, exactly. So I think there is a lot of that. My understanding, and I may be wrong about this, but I think that in England they do it a little bit differently. Like a season of a show, unlike here where you've got, you know, say Lost goes for 22 episodes, like there they'll have a show, you know, like their show MI5, which I believe is called Spooks over there,
yep.
You know, will air for 9 or 12 episodes or whatever it is consecutively and then be replaced by another show when it's done. It, you know, it's not, they don't break it down the way we do with a season and then the summer rerun season. So maybe that has something to do with it as well. I don't know. But, there's definitely been a change in recent years where, you know, like you said, people say, hey, writing is writing. Acting is acting. You know, it's just, is it good or is it bad? That's the concern, not where are you doing it.
Do you think that change is coming as well for television? We see it in cable, where even, you know, it's funny, we talked about the two extremes of network television and like HBO or Showtime, but then there's, you know, a perfect example, like all the shows on FX and Spike, that can go a little bit further from a violence and even a sexual standpoint,
mm-hmm.
not as far as HBO.
Well, and then, interestingly, you're seeing that some of those repackaged for, you know, like Sex and the City being repackaged for TNT.
Yep.
And, you know, apparently it's done very well. I mean, when it was first announced, people were like, well, how's that going to work? And apparently it's done quite well. Yeah, no, and I think from the standpoint of the creators, it's much more satisfying because you can say to yourself, you can come up with an idea, and instead of saying, well, I'm a movie writer, so how do I make this into a movie, you know, or I'm a, you know, book writer, how do I make this into a book, you can say to yourself, what is the best outlet creatively for this idea, and you can target it that way. I mean, my latest credit actually is as creative consultant on an IMAX documentary about Greece, which you will appreciate. It's called Greece Secrets of the Past, and it's in certain IMAX theaters right now.
Cool.
And I was involved in, you know, helping map out the story for that. And there's another one, documentaries. So it's great to be able to go back and forth as a creator and, you know, try this, try that, see what different methods of storytelling work. I mean, one of the things, you know, going to comics, what was interesting is, you know, there wasn't a big learning curve for me because I'd read them all my life, but, you know, you realize, hey, even though in TV and movies you have to be pretty spare and economical with the dialogue, it's even more so in comics because the dialogue is actually right there on the page. You can't have all these huge word balloons covering up the art.
Sure.
You know? So, I mean, it's fun and gratifying from a creative standpoint to work in different media and also educational in terms of learning what works and what doesn't in each one.
Who were the people or what sources helped you, you know, kind of translate it, your style of writing into the comic format? Were there editors? Were there other writers that helped you, or a book or anything
like that?
There
was I got a book called Denny O'Neill wrote it, called Writing. I think just Writing for Comics, the DC Guide to Writing for Comics. Mm-hmm. I think it was, and it was part of it was essentially an expansion in book form of a course he used to give. I think maybe at the School of Visual Arts. I'm not exactly sure where, but he would also do it as a DC editor for, you know, editors and freelancers and what have you. And that was very helpful. That was very helpful in terms of, you know, format and things and that like that. But, you know, having read comics for, you know, however many decades before, you know, writing them, it's sort of in your blood as well. You know, it's some of it's second nature. But, I mean, you can't just jump right into it and expect to, you know, to do it perfectly. So it did help to have that guide.
That's cool.
Now, of course, you know, the individual editors are, you know, and collaborators are very helpful, and artists that you work with, you know, for instance, you know, an artist like, you know, Mike Perkins will often, you know, call up or email and say, you know, can I change this a little bit, you know, because I think it would work better for this reason. And they're like, oh, yeah, that would work better, you know. And
that's cool.
And you learn that way.
And your editors, are they helping as well?
Sorry?
Have your editors been helping as well?
Yes, definitely. I mean, you know, just thinking of Joey Cavalieri, who was my editor on Deadshot, you know, was really good about saying, I think you've got, one of the things that happens when you go from screenwriting to comics is sometimes you call for too many actions in one panel, you know.
Sure.
You have to pick something up before you can throw it, but you may, you know, you may be writing and say, you know, panel one, you know, the Hulk picks up a truck and throws it, you know. Well, you need one panel of him picking it up and another panel of him throwing it, you know, and there were a couple of places where Joey pointed out, you know, you've got two actions in here, so that's going to have to be two panels.
Gotcha.
So, yeah.
And I also was wondering, your work on Law & Order and also on Numbers, were you part of the writing staff, or were you and your wife coming in as freelancers and pitching an idea?
Yeah, my wife and I, we met at film school, and we actually started out writing movies. We wrote several screenplays for studios. You know, I mean, as you probably know, for every one script that gets made, there are 10 or 20 that don't. So, you know, we wrote a number that didn't get made, and then we wrote a couple that did get made. And then we sort of ended up through, you know, mutual acquaintances working in Law & Order on a freelance basis. And so we've, you know, it's kind of interesting because we've never really been nailed down in one area. It's been a little of this, a little of that, and we find that, you know, the most gratifying creatively.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Well, what's coming up? I mean, I think you hinted that there are a couple things coming up that you can't talk about.
Yeah,
so.
No, well, there are some that I can talk about that have already been announced. I'll be doing I'll be writing a Quasar miniseries for 2007 that will sort of spin out of Annihilation.
Very cool.
That'll be fun.
Who's doing the art on that?
Sorry?
Who's doing the art on that?
I know, but I don't think I'm allowed to say because I don't think it's signed, sealed, and delivered yet.
Okay, no problem.
and then it's sort of the flip side. I know I'll be working with Mike Perkins again on something, but I can't say what.
Okay.
There's actually a number of exciting things in the works that, you know, will be seeing the light of day in 2007. So.
Would your wife ever want to jump into the comic book world with you?
No, I asked her. I mean, probably the only way she would want to is if we created something of our own, something original, you know.
Okay.
But I mean, she likes comics, but she didn't grow up reading them, and you know, she doesn't really have any interest in, you know, writing stories about guys in tights beating the crap out of each other, which I love to do. But you know, never, you never say never, and maybe someday we'll work together on an original idea.
So does she read any of the, does she read books? Does she read comics?
Not really.
Okay.
Which
that's
is,
okay.
Which I actually like because I don't have to worry about her, you know, going through my comic boxes and reading my books. but she likes them. I mean, she, you know, and she actually, you know, like many people who didn't grow up with them, she prefers, you know, something like she's read issues of Preacher, which she liked a lot.
That's
and,
cool.
Jonah Hex, she likes a lot. And, you know, things that are not necessarily part of the hardcore continuity universes. Because
that's
I think those are more accessible.
Sure. Well, and I was wondering, what do you think there are elements of television or film that have yet to be tapped by the comics world beyond getting the talent pool of writers like Whedon and these other guys that are now diving in? Do you think there's any, I mean, is it, are they missing something? It seems to me like a good example of like Law and Order, for example. There's a show that really is kind of an anthology show when you get down to it. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, the officers are the constants, but really it seems more so now than even if you go back to those old cop shows or old detective shows where, you know, the crime of the week is really much more of a focus than it, what it used to be in terms of just being the plot device to get Mannix to, you know, drive a car fast and jump around and hit a few people.
Right. Well, I mean, I think, you know, you can always, you know, there are always opportunities to, you know, to say, hey, this worked here, maybe it'll work here. And there, you know, I mean, I think it's what you don't want to do is just try to say, hey, you know, you look at the show Heroes, which Ruth and I, my wife, both love.
Very cool.
And what I think works about Heroes is they didn't just say, let's take a comic book and put it on TV. You know, they didn't have the people wearing costumes. It was more of a real-world approach of like, hey, let's explore people getting powers and figuring out what to do with them, you know. But taking it, I mean, the thing about the costumes is a lot of times when you put those costumes on real people, they look ridiculous. Like, you know, and Christopher Reeve pulled it off. You know, there are people who can pull it off. But
Adam,
you know,
West is a good example of, yeah, I mean, that's why it was such a campy show. The Adam West Batman is a good example.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. I mean, not many people, even celebrities, have those kinds of bodies that they can make the costumes work. So, you know, it's, I think that you can definitely, you know, each medium can learn from the other, but, you know, the smart thing is not to say, well, let's just take something that worked here and replicate it exactly here. It's about saying, you know, what elements of this worked that would also work here, and how can we, you know, take the spirit of this and bring it over in a way that works effectively. And, you know, I think one of the reasons superhero comics have survived so long, whereas other genres have not been as successful, is because comics are the best way to do it. I mean, you know, there is, even with the technology we have today, you know, you can't, you would need like a $1 billion budget to put on the screen what a talented artist can draw, you know?
Sure.
Yeah, exactly.
What'd she say?
What did you say, hon?
I said, which is what they spent on X-Men and what they spent on...
Yeah, you look at what they spent on... I haven't seen it, but the last X-Men movie, you know, I mean, one of the things I've heard is, you know, I think there's a excellent effect with Magneto doing something to the Golden Gate Bridge at the beginning, but then you realize that they spent a lot of their money on that, and, you know, it's not as big you know, in scale, the rest of the movie isn't as big in scale as some people would have liked. And that's, you know, it's an economic thing. But, you know, for an artist, it doesn't cost any more to have Jack Kirby draw two people talking to each other than it does to have him drawing them, you know, throwing planets at each other.
You bet.
So, you know, that's one of the advantages. On the flip side, it would be nice to see a wider variety of genres. Like, it's great that Jonah Hex is out there now with a Western comic, and, you know, there are some good horror comics out there, and, you know, it's nice to see a variety of genres as well.
As we wrap up, can you name some books right now that you're enjoying?
I really like Jonah Hex. I think that Jimmy and Justin are doing a fantastic job with that. I mean, it's like, you know, if anyone who likes the show Deadwood would really like that.
Jimmy's the guy who brought you into comics, is that
Jimmy
correct?
Jimmy did bring me into comics, yes. Yes, he did. We met at a convention and became friends, and, you know, I was in town. Ruth and I were in New York for a shooting of one of our episodes of Law & Order SVU, and you know, Jimmy knew that I really loved comics and would love to write them, and, you know, he said, you know, let me see if I can, you know, get Dan DiDio to sit down with you, and we did, and, you know, it was funny because, you know, Dan and I talked, and I had some ideas, and he had some ideas, and, you know, we ended up talking about what would become the Deadshot miniseries, and he said, yeah, write up a proposal and send it to me, and, you know, I'll get back to you, and I sent it to him, and a couple months went by, and I didn't hear anything, and figured that was it, you know. Well, I tried, you know, and then
sure.
He emailed me one day and said, okay, we're good to go, you know, and I was like, oh, my God, you know, it was fantastic.
Before I get back to more of your comics, I wanted to ask about DiDio. And Quesada as well, but DiDio has that television background, and I don't
yeah.
know how much, you know, direct work you've had with Dan, but can you see that television influence in the way that he is running the DC line?
Well, Dan worked at ABC, and he and I have actually talked about it, and, you know, again, I don't think it's an issue of, you know, running a comic book company like a television company or anything like that. It's more of a perspective type of question in terms of, you know, hey, let's see if we can figure out something really exciting that works, you know, not, well, we can't do this. This is comics, so we can't do X, you know.
Okay.
It's more a lack of boundaries, you know, in terms of, it's not so much saying we're going to do it like this as it's saying there's nothing we can't do. If
okay.
it's good, we can do it. If it's a, you know, if it's going to be a good story, we can do it. I mean, I think that in years past, and I haven't dealt with Joe directly as much, but I think in years past, you know, if you pitched a story about, hey, let's bring back Bucky and Captain America, they would have said to you, you're crazy. You know,
right.
You don't do that. And, you know, Joe was like, well, you know, from what I understand, he was like, well, convince me that that would make a good story. And Ed convinced him, and Tom Brevoort, actually, who was the editor on that book, said, mm-hmm. convince me that would be a good story. And Ed managed to convince them, and guess what? It's been a great story. I loved it. I mean, I was one of the people when I heard about it. I was like, they're crazy.
That sure.
doesn't work. And the lesson is, if it's good, if it's done well, it works. So I think that's where that comes in.
That's cool. And I was wondering more, and I agree with you completely, but I was wondering more in terms of the way both companies are really kind of, you know, have this editorial hand that's saying, this is the general direction of our universes for the next year or 2 years, and it, not in a restraining way, but mm-hmm. to almost say, well, we're following this big overall story. Again, that TV model, it seems, that, you know, a lot more television shows are adopting, as well as this is this season's story,
yeah.
but there's going to be a bunch of individual stories in the middle of it as well.
Right, right. Yeah, I guess, I mean, I think it's definitely at a point now where it's much more organized than it was in the past. And, you know, back in the day, there was less of a, you're right, there was probably less of a guiding hand, a single guiding hand, doing it like that. I don't know. I mean, not having been around, you know,
sure.
in the past, knowing the internal workings of it, it's hard to say, but I just think that both companies are putting out some really great books right now.
No, I agree. Okay. And let's hear some more books that you like right now.
Well, Fables, I think, is fantastic.
Oh yeah.
I really like what Ed and Steve are doing on Captain America.
Cool.
I think Runaways is a great book. Daredevil, I like a lot. I love that whole storyline where he was in jail.
Yeah.
which is another example of something that, you know, you might have seen like one issue where Spider-Man got put in jail or something. But, you know, the whole storyline, I mean, it was great. It was like a great prison movie.
Oh, know? Absolutely.
See what else. I'm probably blanking on 50 great titles that, you know, after I get off the phone with you, I'll
oh, yeah.
kick myself for. But, you know... I mean, there's just a lot of great stuff. Some of the Wildstorm stuff is really good. Ex Machina is fantastic. You know, I think that the knowing where some of the stuff is going, especially, I think that some of the Wildstorm stuff, Gen 13 and, you know, Wildcats and some of that stuff is really exciting. And, you know, and then there's the Vertigo stuff, which, you know, the other side, I've only read a couple of issues of it, but it's really, really amazingly done.
I agree with you.
The Vietnam, yeah, you know the one I'm talking about.
I do know. I know exactly what you're talking about, and yeah, that's, I agree. I think, as you pointed out too with Jonah Hex, it's nice to see that these other genres are finally getting their due, and you're getting some real quality work to show how great these genres can be in the right hands.
Absolutely. So, you know, I mean, I really think, you know, I've been reading comics since, you know, the mid 70s, you know, when I was just a little kid.
Sure.
I think they're better now than they ever were, so.
No, I agree with you. I think there's a lot of competition out there, Chris, and I congratulate you because I think you're coming in at a very good time when there is so much good work out there, and your stuff remains distinct, and I think it's entertaining as well, and it deserves an audience. And no, man, honestly, I talk to the creators that I like, and I wasn't just being nice. I'm enjoying your stuff a lot, and I really loved Deadshot, and I really I love Union Jack. I think it's fantastic.
Cool. Yeah, the reaction has been terrific to Union Jack. The first issue sold out at Diamond.
That's cool.
And the critical, the reader reaction and online and everything, I mean, people love it. So I've been really gratified. Like you said, what with Civil War going on and all this huge stuff, it's great that people are, noticing and enjoying, that book.
Well, you and I think Frank Terry, too, are like two guys that are on the Marvel side alone that are really, we're writing some really interesting stuff because I loved his Underworld series.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I hope these books are finding the audience, and that's the thing sometimes when it's always event, it's like, man, you're stepping on some really good books. I told Jeff Parker that with Agents of Atlas. That's another great book that I thought, deserves a bigger audience and stuff. So.
Yeah. Well, hopefully there's room for everything, and I think, I think that the attention is being gotten I know Agents of Atlas has gotten some good press, and Union Jack is definitely, like I said, the first issue is completely sold out at Diamond, and there's definitely going to be a trade paperback coming, and it's nice. It's nice when people are noticing, even amidst all the sound and fury of everything else. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Congrats on what you're doing with Union Jack, and I look forward to the rest of Stormwatch, and of course, Casualties of War, Iron Man and Cap, and everything else that's coming up. So nice going.
All right, man. Thanks for calling.
That's Christos Gage. Make sure you check out all of his DC, Marvel, and Wildstorm projects coming up. And that'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks a lot for listening. This is John Suntress. Have any questions, comments, or feedback you'd like to share? I'm always available at my website. john@wordballoon.com is the email address. There's also our MySpace page, myspace.com/wordballoon. And if you didn't know, we're up on iTunes, Podcast Alley, Podcast Pickle, Odeo, all the various podcatchers. So if you care to write a review at iTunes or leave any votes over at Podcast Alley, we certainly would appreciate it. Make sure you keep listening. Lots more great stuff coming up throughout the holiday season from Word Balloon. We don't sleep. We don't stop. More episodes on the way. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2006.